Security by Poole Anderson, Part 4. The corrected equations provided an adequate theory of superdielectricity, a theory with tantalizing hints about still other phenomena, and gave the research team a precise idea of what they wanted in the way of crystal structure. Actually, the substance to be formed was only semicrystalline, with plastic features as well, all interwoven with a grid of carbon-linked atoms. Now, the trick was to produce that stuff. Calculation revealed what elements would be needed and what spatial arrangement. Only, how did you get the atoms to assume the required configuration and hook up in the right way? Theory would get you only so far. Thereafter, it was cut and try. Lancaster rolled up his sleeves with the rest and let Karen take over the leadership. She was the best experimenter. He spent some glorious and all but sleepless weeks, greasy, dirty, living in a jungle of haywired apparatus with a restless slide rule. There were plenty of failures, a lot of heartbreak and profanity, an occasional injury, but they kept going, and they got there. The day came, or was it the night, when Karen took a slab of darkly shining substance out of the furnace where it had been heat aging. Rakan sawed it into several chunks for testing. It was Lancaster who worked on the electric properties. He applied voltage to his generator, groaned, and watched in awe as meters climbed and climbed without any sign of stopping. He discharged the accumulated energy in a single blue flare that filled the lab with thunder and ozone. He tested for time lag of an electric signal and wondered wildly if it didn't feel like sleeping on its weary path. The reports came in, excited yells from one end of the long cluttered room to the other, exultant whoops and men pounding each other on the back. This was it! This was the treasure at the rainbow's end. The substance and its properties were physically and chemically stable over a temperature range of hundreds of degrees. The breakdown voltage was up in the millions. The insulation resistance was better than the best known to Earth science. The dielectric constant could be varied at will by a simple electric field normal to the applied voltage gradient, a field which could be generated by a couple of dry cells if need be, and ranged from 100,000 to about 3 billion. For all practical purposes, here was the ultimate dielectric. "We did it!" Friedrich slapped Lancaster's back till he felt that the ribs must crack. "We have it!" "Whoopee!" yelled Karen. Suddenly, they had joined hands and were dancing idiotically around the induction furnace. Lancaster clasped Rakan's talons without caring that it was a Martian. They sang then, sang till heads appeared at the door and the glassware shivered. "Here we go round the mulberry bush, the mulberry bush, the mulberry bush." It called for a celebration. The end of a project meant no more than filing a last report and waiting for the next assignment. But they ran things differently out here. Somebody broke out a case of Venusian agua caliente. Somebody else led the way to a storeroom, tossed its contents into the hall, and festooned it with used computer tape. Rakan forgot his Martian dignity and fiddled for a square dance, with Isaacson doing the calling. The folk from the other end of the station swarmed in, till the place overflowed. It was quite a party. Hours later, Lancaster was hazily aware of lying stretched on the floor. His head was in Karen's lap, and she was stroking his hair. The hardy survivors were following the Dufrères in French drinking songs, which are the best in the known universe. Rakan's fiddle wove in and out, a lovely accompaniment to voices that were untrained, but made rich and alive by triumph. "Sur ma tombe, je veux qu'on inscrive, ici j'ai le roi de vos vœux. Sur ma tombe, je veux qu'on inscrive, ici j'ai le roi de vos vœux. Ici j'ai, oui, 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 ici j'ai, non, non, non. Ici j'ai le roi de vos vœux."
Lancaster knew that he had never been really happy before. "Ici j'ai, non, non, non,
ici j'ai le roi de vos vœux." Berg showed up a couple of days later, looking worried. Lancaster's vacation time was almost up. When he heard the news, his eyes snapped gleefully and he pumped the physicist's hand. "Good work, boy!" "There are things to clean up yet," said Lancaster, "but it's all detail. Anybody can do it." "And the material? What do you call it, anyway?"
Karen grinned.
"So far, we've only named it Futz.
That's stuff spelled backwards."
"Okay, okay. It's easy to manufacture."
"Sure. Now that we know how, anybody can make it in his own home, if he's handy at tinkering apparatus together."
"Fine, fine. Just what was needed. This is the ticket."
Berg turned back to Lancaster.
"Okay, boy, you can pack now. We blast again in a few hours."
The physicist shuffled his feet.
"What are my chances of getting reassigned back here?" he asked. "I've liked it immensely, and now that I know about it anyway..."
"I'll see. I'll see. But remember, this is top secret. You go back to your regular job and don't say a word on this to anyone less than the president. No matter what happens, understand?"
"Of course," snapped Lancaster, irritated. "I know my duty."
"Yeah, so you do," Berg sighed. "So you do."
Leave-taking was tough for all concerned. They had grown fond of the quiet, bashful man. And, as for him, he wondered how he'd get along among normal people. These were his sort. Karen wept openly, and kissed him goodbye with a fervor that haunted his dreams afterward. Then she stumbled desolately back to her quarters. Even Berg looked grim. He regained his cockiness on the trip home, though, and insisted on talking all the way. Lancaster, who wanted to be alone with his thoughts, was annoyed. But you don't insult a security man.
"You understand the importance of this whole business, and why it has to be secret?" nagged Berg. "I'm not thinking of the scientific and industrial applications, but the military ones."
"Oh, sure. You can make lightning throwers if you want to. And you've overcome the fuel problem. With a few Futz accumulators, you charge from any handy power source, you can build fuel-less military vehicles, which would simplify your logistics immensely. And some really deadly handguns could be built. Pistols the equivalent of a cannon, almost." Lancaster's voice was dead.
"So what?"
"So plenty. Those are only a few of the applications. If you use your imagination, you can think of dozens more. And the key point is, the Futz and the essential gadgetry using it are cheap to make in quantity, easy to handle. The perfect weapon for the citizen soldier. Or for the rebel. It isn't enough to decide the outcome of a war all by itself, but it may very well be precisely the extra element which will tip the military balance against the government. And I've already discussed what that means."
"Yes, I remember. That's your department, not mine. Just let me forget about it."
"You'd better," said Berg.
In the month after his return, Lancaster lived much as usual. He was scolded a few times for an increasing absent-mindedness and a lack of enthusiasm on the project, but that wasn't too serious. He became more of an introvert than ever. Having some difficulty with getting to sleep, he resorted to soporifics, and then, in a savage reaction, to stimulants. But outwardly, there was little to show the turmoil within him. He didn't know what to think. He had always been a loyal citizen. Not a fanatic, but loyal. And it wasn't easy for him to question his own basic assumptions. But he had experienced something utterly alien to what he considered normal. And he had found the strangeness more congenial, more human in every way, than the norm. He had breathed a different atmosphere, and it couldn't but seem to him that the air of Earth was tainted. He reread Kipling's Chant Pagan with a new understanding, and began to search into neglected philosophies. He studied the news in detail, and his critical eye soon grew jaundiced. Did this editorial or that feature story have any semantic content at all, or was it only a tom-tom beat of loaded connotations? The very statements of fact were subject to doubt.
They should be checked against other accounts, or better yet, against direct observation. But other accounts were forbidden, and there was no chance to see for himself. He took to reading seditious pamphlets, with some care, and listened to a number of underground broadcasts, and tried, clumsily, to sound out those of his acquaintances whom he suspected of rebellious thoughts. It all had to be done very cautiously, with occasional nightmare moments when he thought he was being spied on. And was it right that a man should be afraid to hear a dissenting opinion? He wondered what his son was doing. It occurred to him that modern education existed largely to stultify independent thought. At the same time, he was unable to discard the beliefs of his whole life. Sedition was sedition, and treason was treason. You couldn't evade that fact. There were no more wars. Plenty of minor clashes, but no real wars. There was a stable economy, and nobody lacked for the essentials. The universal state might be a poor solution to the problems of a time of troubles, but it was nevertheless a solution. Change would be unthinkably dangerous. Dangerous to whom? To the entrenched powers and their jackals. But the oppressed peoples of Earth had nothing to lose, really, except their lives, and many of them seemed quite willing to sacrifice those. Did the rights of man stop at a full belly, or was there more? He tried to take refuge in cynicism. After all, he was well off. He was a successful jackal. But that wouldn't work either. He required a more basic philosophy. One thing that held him back was the thought that if he became a rebel, he would be pitted against his friends. Not only those of Earth, but that strange, joyous crew out in space. He couldn't see fighting against them. Then there was the very practical consideration that he hadn't the faintest idea of how to contact the underground, even if he wanted to, and he'd make a hell of a poor conspirator. He was still in an unhappy and undecided whirlpool when the monitors came for him. They knocked on the door at midnight, as was their custom, and he felt such an utter panic that he could barely make it across the apartment to let them in. The four burly men wavered before his eyes, and there was a roaring and a darkness in his head. They arrested him without ceremony on suspicion of treason, which meant that habeas corpus and even the right of trial didn't apply. Two of them escorted him to a car. The other two stayed to search his dwelling. At headquarters he was put in a cell and left to stew for some hours. Then a pair of men in the uniform of the federal police led him to a questioning chamber. He was given a chair, and a smiling, soft-voiced man, almost fatherly, with his plump cheeks and white hair, offered him a cigarette and began talking to him.
"Just relax, Dr. Lancaster. This is pretty routine. If you've nothing to hide, then you've nothing to fear. Just tell the truth."
"Of course."
It was a dry whisper.
"Oh, you're thirsty. So sorry.
Alec, get Dr. Lancaster a glass of water, will you please? And, by the way, my name is Harris. Let's call this a friendly conference, eh?"
Lancaster drank avidly. Harris's manner was disarming, and the physicist felt more at ease. This was... well, it was just a mistake, or maybe a simple spot check. Nothing to fear. He wouldn't be sent to camp, not he. Such things happen to other people, not to Alan Lancaster.
"You've been immunized against Neoscop?" asked Harris.
"Yes, it's routine for my rank and over, you know, in case we should ever be kidnapped. But why am I telling you this?"
Lancaster tried to smile. His face felt stiff.
Yes, too bad."
"Of course, I've no objection at all to your using a lie detector on me."
"Fine, fine."
Harris beamed and gestured to one of the expressionless policemen. A table was wheeled forth, bearing the instrument.
"I'm glad you're so cooperative, Dr. Lancaster. You've no idea how much trouble it saves me. And you."
They ran a few harmless calibrating questions. Then Harris said, still smiling,
"And now tell me, Dr. Lancaster, where were you really this summer?"
Lancaster felt his heart leap into his throat, and knew in a sudden terror that the dials were registering his reaction.
"Why, I took my vacation," he stammered. "I was in the Southwest." "The machine doesn't quite agree with you."
Harris remained impishly cheerful.
"But it's true! You can check back and..."
"There are such things as doubles, you know. Come, come now, let's not waste the whole night. We both have many other things to do."
"I... look!"
Lancaster gulped down his panic and tried to speak calmly. "Suppose I am lying. The machine should tell you that I'm not doing so out of disloyalty. There are things I can't tell anyone without clearance. Like if you ask me about my work on the project. I can't tell you that. Why don't you check through regular security channels? There was a man called Berg. At least he called himself that. You'll find that it's all perfectly okay with security."
"You can tell me anything," said Harris gently.
"I can't tell you this. Not anybody short of the president," Lancaster caught himself. "Of course, that's assuming I did really spend the summer for something other than my vacation, but..."
Harris sighed.
"I was afraid of this. I'm sorry, Lancaster."
He nodded to his policeman.
"Go ahead, boys."
Lancaster kept sliding into unconsciousness. They jolted him back to life with stimulant injections and vigorous slaps and resumed working on him. Now and then they would let up, and Harris's face would swim out of a haze of pain, smiling, friendly, sympathetic, offering him a smoke or a shot of whiskey. Lancaster sobbed and wanted more than anything else in the world to do as that kindly man asked. But he didn't dare. He knew what happened to those who revealed state secrets. Finally, he was thrown back into his cell and left to himself. When he recovered from his faint, that was a very slow process. He had no idea of how many hours or days had gone by. There was a water tap in the room, and he drank thirstily, vomited the liquid up again, and sat with his head in his hands. "So far," he thought dully. They hadn't done too much to him. He was short several teeth, and there were some broken fingers and toes, and maybe a floating kidney. The other bruises, lacerations, and burns would heal all right if they got the chance. Only they wouldn't. He wondered vaguely how security had gotten onto his track. Berg's precautions had been very thorough. So thorough, apparently, that Harris could find no trace of what had really happened that summer, and was going only on suspicion. But what had made him suspicious in the first place? An anonymous tip-off? From whom? Maybe some enemy, some rival on the project, had chosen this way of getting rid of his sector chief. In the end, Lancaster thought wearily, he'd tell. Why not do it now? Then, probably, he'd only be shot for betraying Berg's confidence. That'd be the easy way out. No, he'd hang on for a while yet. There was always a faint chance. His cell door opened, and two guards came in. He was past flinching from them, but he had to be supported on his way to the questioning room. Harris sat there, still smiling.
"How do you do, Dr. Lancaster?"
he said politely.
"Not so well, thank you."
The grin hurt his face.
"I'm sorry to hear that. But really, it's your own fault. You know that."
"I can't tell you anything," said Lancaster. "I'm under security oath.
I can't speak of this to anyone under the president."
Harris looked annoyed. "Don't you think the president has better things to do than come running to every enemy of the state that yaps after him?"
"There's been some mistake, I tell you," pleaded Lancaster.
"I'll say there has, and you're the one who's made it. Go ahead, boys."
Harris picked up a magazine and started reading. After a while, Lancaster focused his mind on Karen Marek and kept it there. That helped him bear up. If they knew out in the station what was happening to him, they wouldn't forget him, try to pretend they'd never known him, as the little fearful people of Earth did. They'd speak up and do their damnedest to save their friend. The blows seemed to come from very far away. They didn't do things like this out in the station. Lancaster realized the truth at that moment, but it held no surprise. The most natural thing in the world. And now, of course, he'd never talk. Maybe. When he woke up, there was a man before him. The face blurred, seemed to grow to monstrous size, and then move out to infinite distances. The voice of Harris had a ripple in it, wavering up and down, up and down.
"All right, Lancaster, here's the president. Since you insist, here he is."
"Go ahead, American," said the man. "Tell me. It's your duty."
"No," said Lancaster.
"But I am the president. You wanted to see me."
"Most likely a double. Prove your identity." The man who looked like the president sighed and turned away. End of part 4 of Security.